It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Two major developments are moving forward in Pittsburgh's Hill District. One community-generated, the other led by the Penguins. Marimba Malayans is the CEO of the Hill Community Development Corporation. She joins us in studio. Welcome to The Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for having me this morning.
Of course. So the Penguins and their partners are to update the community this evening about the plans to redevelop the former Civic Arena site. Penguins were given the development rights to the 28-acre site as part of that deal to remain in Pittsburgh and getting a new arena. So, Marimba, what do you need to hear? What do you think the community needs to hear from this update from the Penguins?
Well, there hasn't been a community update in quite some time. So I think the community, one, is looking forward to just hearing, you know, what the status of the development is. We've seen some news articles come out, but there's not necessarily been a community meeting. And so I think people just want to understand, is this really going to happen? What is the timeline? What are the principles that are advancing relative to the community benefits agreement? So I think those are the things the community will be looking for this evening.
And briefly explain for people who aren't aware what a community benefits agreement is all about.
Sure. A community benefits agreement is essentially an agreement normally between a community or a community group, a public agency, and a private developer. And normally it is triggered when a development receives public subsidy, particularly large amounts of public subsidy, which is essentially tax money. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that there should be public gain for public dollars into a development.
Mm-hmm. There have been a series of delays to start putting shovels into the ground, if you will, including U.S. Steel announcing would put a headquarters there. It was in late 2014, and then about a year later in 15, deciding not to build its new headquarters. Have the delays been frustrating, do you think?
Oh, I think that the entire region has really wanted to see this development advance for quite some time. For the Hill District in particular, I think that the challenge has mostly been the how challenging it has been to predict the market within the Middle Hill District and the Upper Hill District, given the starts and stops that the Lower Hill District has faced. Mm-hmm. And so, as you may know, developers oftentimes want to know what's happening in the broader area of development. And so that development is easily over $1.5 billion in terms of scale. And so that will have a considerable impact on market studies and, you know, development opportunity. And so without being clear about when things were going to get started, I do think that made it a bit challenging to advance some of the development in the Middle and Upper Hill District. However, fortunately, we have been self-determined. There's been lots going on in the meantime. And so I think now people are really ready to see the development advance. And that's where we are. So we're looking forward to the meeting this evening. Really wanting to see where things stand. The Hill CDC is represented on the Executive Management Committee, which governs the Community Benefits Agreement that, you know, governs the document. You may hear it referred to as the CSIP, or Community Collaboration and Implementation Plan. Mm-hmm. And we meet with the Pens in the city and other representatives on every other week to discuss the progress of the implementation agreement as it relates to the development.
So are the delays okay as long as you get it right?
Well, you know, I think at some point it has to advance, namely because, there's a part of the agreement is to assure that half of the tax dollars that are generated from the site are reinvested into the Middle Hill District and the Upper Hill District. And then the other half gets invested into the Lower Hill District's infrastructure. So without being able to, really predict or anticipate when that revenue flow will come back into the neighborhood, it is a challenge. But I do think, you know, I think of all the time that I've been involved in the Lower Hill District, which has been quite some time now, this really is the time that it's going to start. And so, you know, kudos to the new team that the Penguins have put into place in order to advance the development. I think that's been helpful. And, you know, we're really ready to move forward.
And of course, the plan is to still include, I believe, more than 1,400 new units of housing, lots of square feet of office space, retail, music venue, and a hotel. So I wanted to ask you, do you feel it's been a partnership, the community, the Penguins, and the city, or has it been more like community will keep you informed?
I think it's evolved. I think that initially it was more of a, you know, kind of community was on one side and, you know, the Penguins were on another side, and the government was just trying to figure out, you know, how to navigate between the two entities. Mm-hmm. But I think that over the past year, it has really evolved into more of a collaboration. You know, I am someone who measures, you know, success by outcomes. And so, you know, I can't speak to the success of anything right now because we still cannot measure outcomes. But I am hopeful that the table that is set now and that the relationships that have evolved will support development that, you know, aligns with the community's master plan. And that is also something that will catalyze, you know, economic development for not just the Hill District, but our region.
All right. So are you confident or just hopeful that it will just sort of complement, fit into the community's master plan?
Oh, I think that the community collaboration implementation plan certainly is very specific. It really deals with several areas ranging from economic development to workforce development to cultural legacy to housing. And so it is a detailed document. We are in the process right now of securing funding to bring on a project administrator for that role to help govern that document and make sure that it's implemented. So at this stage, you know, I'm both hopeful. I'm cautiously optimistic in terms of my confidence level. just because the nature of development is complex. But I do, you know, we plan to remain at the table. We plan to keep the community at the table. And we plan to continue to advocate for what has been agreed on.
And the Penguins and their partners have said they intend to break ground on the first component, be some housing, later this year in the fall. So
yes.
You sound a bit optimistic that's going to happen.
Well, I think that's their intention. And I do think they will break ground very soon. I cannot speak to whether or not it will actually be October, but I do think it's imminent.
Okay. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with Marimba Malayan, CEO of the Hill CDC, about movement in two developments in the Hill District. And let's talk a little bit about that second development, a long-awaited development. It's the block on Center Avenue that's home to the New Granada Theater. This, would you say, is a community-generated development as opposed to a privately-led development? Mm-hmm. And how do you see the difference between the two?
Yeah, well, I think that this is absolutely a community-generated agreement, a development. The Hill CDC owns the New Granada Theater and has for quite some time and is focused on revitalizing that entire block, which we refer to as New Granada Square. And New Granada Square will contain the historic New Granada building, which is a 40,000-square-foot historic structure, with an additional 20,000 square feet of office space, 7,200 square feet of retail space, and 40 mixed income artist preference housing units. And so we are very excited. This project is easily over $55 million. We are getting towards the end of our capital stack. And so we're really excited this project is advancing. As you may know, we've been working on this project for quite some time. And that's really the role of community developers. We really stand in the gap and work in communities before market rate developers are comfortable taking the risk. And so that's really what we've been doing.
Is the mission, the goal different when it's a community development, community-led generated development versus a private development?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, private developers generally in the business to make money.
And
right?
It should be, yeah.
Right. I mean, and that's fine. It's a for-profit business. Whereas nonprofit organizations are really, the profit is the mission. Now, nonprofits should not get confused that they can operate at a deficit and remain solvent or you know, grow in terms of, you know, longevity or maintain their organization. We should also be able to profit to some degree financially. However, the profit is really in the mission for community-based organizations and nonprofits. And so we are able to take some risks that private developers are not comfortable taking. However, there should be equity in terms of real estate development in our communities. And so one of the things we promote is community ownership in partnership with private developers. This holds private developers accountable and also makes sure that there's reinvestment into communities.
You alluded to that it's been a long time coming, a lot of work, shall we say, behind the scenes in doing this. So what's happening next? Is it capitalization? What is going to happen and when?
Yes, we are in the process of really closing our final gaps for the New Granada Theater project. You may know that we are using new market tax credits, historic tax credits. We have recently been designated as an opportunity zone. So, you know, how we may be able to leverage those funds from opportunity zone funds is also a critical question. Excuse me. We're waiting right now to hear from the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency to see if we are going to be awarded for New Granada Square Apartments, which is the 7,200 square feet of retail and 40 mixed income artist preference housing units right there between, those of you who are familiar with the Hill District, Black Beauty, and the credit union. And so we'll know in June whether that's funded. So we're super excited, from my lips to God's ears, that will be funded. And the rest of the project is also, we slate and expect to be able to fund the rest of the project this year.
What's the projected cost of the overall project? What your dream is?
Yeah, the project is really about $55 million. And so we are, you know, that is a catalytic project. The whole Center Avenue corridor is really moving towards RFQ over the next several months. You will see an RFQ for the corridor. But this is the project that the community wants to see. This is the project that really, really, I think, combines. You talk about confluence, really combines and brings together community, culture, art, economic development, and education. And so we're really thrilled about that confluence.
We only have about a minute left. We often hear the term equitable development. What does that mean to you, and specifically the New Granada Theater Project?
Yeah, well, equitable development in the New Granada Theater has been built in because we are the community agency and we have centered the community. We have centered the cultural legacy of the community. We have made sure that we will make sure that we meet the metrics and goals of the Greater Hill District Master Plan, which is something that we expect all developments to meet. And we have a development review panel to make sure that that happens. We've successfully gone through the community process with the New Granada Theater. And so I would say community ownership and equitable development, or equitable development specifically, means that the community is a part, not just of visioning, monitoring, but also ownership. We cannot preserve affordability in our city. We cannot preserve culture in our city. We cannot do those things if communities are not partners in private real estate development deals. And so I think we need to really rethink equity and equitable development from that standpoint.
In just a couple of sentences, a lot of work, years of it, putting together a plan and how to fund it. When do you think we'll see the visible signs, construction of it moving forward?
Well, we are actually going to have an interim development opening this summer in July. So anyone who's interested in following the Hill District, you can follow us at hilldistrict.org or the Hill CDC, and we will be opening what we call Hill Works at New Granada in July. So come out to that event, and we'll share the rest of the opening date with you.
All right. Marimba Malines is the CEO of the Hill Community Development Corporation. Marimba, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Coming up in The Confluence, in 2017, Pittsburgh police had a rape closure rate nearly double the national average. It looks good on paper, but is it success or a misclassification? A new report finds Pittsburgh is one of the easiest regions for people to save up just in case of emergency. But the reason why isn't necessarily a good thing. And several hundred wildfires erupt across Pennsylvania every year. Officials have built 16 new lookout towers to help spot them. Plus, just ahead, longtime city councilor Darlene Harris might be facing her toughest re-election bid ever. More from The Confluence is just ahead on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Sophie Maslow defeats four rivals in the Democratic primary, essentially guaranteeing her victory for the November election in 1989. Maslow would go on to become the city's first and only female mayor and the first Jewish person to hold the office. Maslow was born in Pittsburgh's Hill District and worked as a clerk in the county courts before being elected to Pittsburgh City Council in 1976. As mayor, she's remembered for her devotion to fiscal responsibility and for privatizing city organizations including the zoo, the aviary, Phipps, and the Schenley Park Golf Course. Maslow died in 2014. She has a street named after her, a seal at the zoo, and a fireboat. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. To many residents, Pittsburgh City Councilor Darlene Harris is known as a thorn in Mayor Bill Peduto's side. But 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy reports she now faces a heated city council election with a mayor-endorsed candidate and a former colleague on the Pittsburgh School Board.
In recent years, Harris has frequently voted against Peduto's agenda in council. Most recently, she opposed controversial legislation to ban certain firearms, accessories, and ammunition within the city. Gun rights groups are suing over the legislation.
I make it very clear to read whatever laws it is. And if people think I'm just trying to disagree, I make sure that I say, and here's where it's at.
Harris lives in the Spring Hill neighborhood and prides herself as an animal rights champion, bringing free spay and neuter programs to the city. She says one of her proudest accomplishments is her help in saving the pension fund. In 2010, the city had a bid to lease its parking facilities for $220 million. That money was supposed to go to the pension fund, but Harris says parking rates would have soared. Council rejected the measure. These days, Harris says she deals with landslides and other environmental issues. One of them includes running double-stack trains through the north side, which she opposes. She notes pollution concerns and a railroad accident last year near Station Square.
One of the double-stack trains fell off the tracks, and thank God that wasn't in one of our neighborhoods.
For the third time, Harris is facing a rival in Bobby Wilson of Spring Hill. Wilson says residents need more access to the office, and he would hold more office hours on the north side.
Currently, there's just not as many people that really have a say in their neighborhood or have as much access as others.
Wilson has been endorsed by Peduto, which has drawn criticism. One former candidate called him a puppet. Wilson didn't respond to that accusation directly, but he said he'd like to see more follow-through from the administration for initiatives like Complete Streets, which would create a traffic grid that welcomes drivers, cyclists, and pedestrians.
I mean, that's also a two-way street, though. You need the council person to be willing to make sure that these projects are done.
Mark Brentley, who lives on the north side, says the district is growing, but not every neighborhood is benefiting. Brentley says, quote, everyday folks don't have access to the opportunities in the area.
We have to find a way to continue to create affordable housing. And so my challenge is also fighting for the affordable housing.
Brentley has run for city council in the past, and he was a school board member, as was Harris. The two were often at odds on district issues. Brentley says he is tired of seeing fighting between the mayor and Harris. But Brentley himself faults the administration for firing him from his job as a public works laborer in January.
I think there's some strange coincidences that just seem to happen, even if it wasn't related to my candidacy.
The city says that Brentley failed to comply with City Works rules, and his firing was handled by the Independent Civil Service Commission, not the Peduto administration. Harris has gotten support from a number of unions, including firefighters, plumbers, and electrical workers. She has also received the endorsement of Democratic Party committee people. Wilson has received financial support from Peduto, Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, and other allies. The primary election is May 21st, and while the district is heavily Democratic, the outcome may not decide the winner. Two candidates who dropped out in the spring may run in the fall. I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Wildfires in Pennsylvania hardly compare to the massive blazes that burn the West each summer, but several hundred smaller fires occur across the state each spring. To better detect them, conservation officials just built 16 new lookout towers. As part of State Impact Pennsylvania's ongoing coverage of climate change, 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk takes us to the Mashannon Forest District.
I'm riding shotgun with three guys from the district through the Pennsylvania wilds. We're taking back roads, swerving around potholes until we come to a fork. John Hecker manages this forest for the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources.
That's the road we'll go to the new tower.
Yep.
And the old tower is just right up here.
These towers are 2 miles apart. Though they function almost identically, the first one we visit can be rickety in the wind. It's 98 years old. Its four iron legs are cemented into the grassy hilltop.
One over there is cracked, but we have three good ones.
That's Larry Bickle. He's a forest fire warden who retired from the Mashannon District 2 years ago. He spent a lot of time staffing the tower we're about to climb.
Do you mind heights, by the way?
Well, we'll find out.
Okay.
60 feet up, we open a wooden hatch to a small room. The view is spectacular. So is the wind. Bickle is at home here.
This is a soul-searching thing. It's not for everybody. I've solved a lot of problems in my life up in this tower.
DCNR built many towers in the 1920s and 30s. Hecker says the state's landscape changed drastically back then.
At the turn of the century, this whole area would have been clear-cut.
The lumber was used to build a growing nation, and massive fires tore through what was left behind. Today, the area is again covered in trees. Joe Pulaski is the fire forester for Meshannon, and he points out that most branches are still pretty bare this time of year.
You can see how, like, the clouds are broken here and the sunlight's coming down, and all the trees don't have leaves on them yet, so you can see how everything would dry out.
By late May, tree leaves will block the sun from reaching the brush underneath, so the ground stays wet after it rains, preventing fires from starting. This is the first fire season for the 16 new towers built in Pennsylvania last year. Gary Weber in Idaho with the Forest Fire Lookout Association was surprised by the project.
First reaction is, really? We'll believe it when we see it.
Over the past few decades, he's seen many states end their lookout programs.
Nationwide, we figure there were somewhere over 9,000 lookout structures built along the way, and probably somewhere a little over 2,500 actually left standing, but a lot of those are just abandoned.
He estimates 500 are still staffed as states turn to other methods of fire detection like planes, cameras, and citizen reports from cell phones. Mike Kern heads DCNR's Division of Forest Fire Protection. He says most of Pennsylvania's new lookouts replaced aging ones at the same location. The agency staffs about 24 towers on warm, dry, windy days in the spring.
There are a lot of places that if people see smoke, they'll get 10 calls to the 911 center. There's other places in north central PA especially that, you know, nobody might see a fire for a couple hours.
Even if someone wanted to report a fire, they'd have a hard time finding cell service out here. That's one of the reasons why five of the new towers are in the Meshannon Forest District. Hecker says the alternative is paying upwards of $1,000 per hour for a plane to search for fires.
Our towers always spot the smoke quicker because just a little tiny column of smoke comes up. They're looking at that against the blue of the horizon and they can spot that.
Humans cause most of the state's wildfires, which tend to be pretty small. Yet in 2016, more than 8,000 acres burned in the Poconos. Kern says the $4 million plus price tag for the new towers is worth it if it means catching fires early.
If we have, you know, one big fire, we could spend $1 million or $2 million to put it out. Look at it that way, you can recoup the cost of a tower pretty easily if you can prevent those fires from getting large.
The Meshannon District is no longer using that 98-year-old tower now that a new one has gone up on Chestnut Ridge nearby, with a clearer view to the north. Bickle, who spent much of his career in the old towers, is blown away when he walks in for the first time.
This is much better. You can get a little idea where the valleys are, where the rivers are. You know, I can see where the river flows the whole way through. There's the power plant.
He grabs a pair of binoculars and starts scanning for smoke. Next to him is a round table with a map of the surrounding area. It has a metal bar that spins, with screws sticking up from both ends. When there's a fire, Bickle would line up the screws with the smoke, then call it in. He demonstrates.
Yeah, Clearfield, I'm spotting the smoke. You ready to copy?
Copy, go ahead.
Okay, Clearfield, I'm seeing the smoke at 236 degrees at approximately 7 miles.
Back in the Forest District office, one of the dispatchers, like Kay Robison, gets to work.
And if there is another tower that might be able to see the fire, then we contact them to see if there's anything that they're seeing, any smoke, to kind of cross the hairs to stop the fire quicker.
She can then triangulate its location to direct firefighters on the ground to the flames. She'll dispatch Forest District employees, but DCNR also works with a lot of volunteer fire departments, and sometimes they're closer to the action and can get there first. Bickle recalls one day 5 years ago.
Talked to the tower operator, you know, he said, smoke there, smoke there, smoke there, smoke there, smoke there.
11 fires broke out.
So I was asking State Parks Rangers to chase smoke for me.
This year is much calmer thanks to abundant rain. Meshannon's only staffed its new towers a few days. Statewide, just 500 acres have burned, compared to the usual 3,000 by the start of May. A DCNR report suggests climate change could result in more wildfires, though that hasn't happened so far. Regardless, the new towers will be here for years to come. Their spotters signing off after a long day's work watching the forest.
Clearfield Chestnut Ridge Tower out of service.
Copy that.
Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WESA, WHYY, WITF, and the Allegheny Front, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Worst case scenario, you lose your income for as long as 6 months. Are you able to pay for your basics with just your savings? A new report by Bankrate.com finds that the Pittsburgh metro area is among the easiest cities to accrue enough emergency savings to get you through in a pinch. But the reason might surprise you. Adrian Garcia is a data analyst with Bankrate.com, a personal finance website. Adrian, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Adrian, how much would you say is appropriate for a proper rainy day fund?
Well, most financial experts are recommending that we put away 6 months worth of our expenses. That can be tough, but the most important thing is to start saving, whether it's 3 months you set aside or if you feel more comfortable with a year. Saving is the key to reach any of those goals.
What do you include in the basics in terms of covering those basic costs? Transportation, food, what do you include?
Well, it would be anything that's not an essential, not a non-essential. And so that's, we can think about it, the roof over our head. So housing, whether that's paying your mortgage or rent, transportation, you need to keep, if you're making vehicle payments or traveling to or from work, keep those up. Groceries, utilities, we want to keep the lights on. Those are the main ones. The last one was health costs, just a roundabout.
So how do you then determine which cities were the best savers?
So we looked at housing costs across the board. They vary widely, even though they've been going up in a lot of places. And we held typical spending on other places like groceries. If you spend 15% of your pre-tax income on groceries or utilities, we kind of came up with numbers for that. But Pittsburgh was fortunate because it had a relatively moderate housing, median housing price, and relatively good median household income, about $56,000, $49,000 after taxes. Mm-hmm.
So factoring those local costs that you mentioned, how much do you project that Pittsburgh area residents should save for this six-month emergency savings fund?
Well, the typical family, and remember, it's going to vary because we kind of base ours on if you're making the median income and have a mortgage. If you have a larger family, you're going to want more, but just throwing that out there. Our study said that you should have about $16,000, close to $17,000 saved up for this 6 months.
And about how long would you estimate it would take to get to that amount of, you know, $16,000 to $17,000?
In Pittsburgh, so again, if you're just spending money on groceries, your housing costs, you're not going out to eat a lot, you've cut your Netflix bill, you could probably do it in 13 months, and that's buying only essentials. We at Bankrate realized that most people are not going to cut out everything. We need to buy things that are economists call non-essentials, but like toothbrushes, which we all need. So it's going to maybe be a little harder, but ideal case, you can do it in almost a year.
It would be difficult to find any room for treats, even small things, make life a little more special now and then.
Yeah, I think that's what our study highlights is this is a best case scenario. You get it in 13 months, you've cut everything else. We know it's going to be harder to save that. So people need to be really cognizant in doing those personal finance 101s if they haven't, like breaking out the budget and opening a savings account.
So you gave us some reasons why Pittsburgh is the fourth easiest metro area to save in the nation. But Pittsburgh also has a lower than average median income. Shouldn't that lower income hurt our collective ability to save?
Yeah, the fortunate thing is you also have a lower relatively median home price. I think in Pittsburgh we used Adam Data Solutions, and they have the median home price at about $150,000. If you look at the bottom of the list where L.A. and San Jose and other areas in California are, median home prices are above $600,000. So you, even though you have a lower median income, your home prices are relatively lower as well. Mm-hmm.
So it's really not that Pittsburghers are saving more. Rather, it's a lower cost of living, and they actually have to save less to build up that emergency fund?
That's key, yeah. When you have larger expenses because your housing charges go up, you're going to need to save more. Pittsburgh's, hopefully, most people there are finding that it's affordable and they have more opportunity to save, and hopefully people are taking advantage of that.
Memphis, according to your study, Memphis is the easiest to save, another rebounding mid-sized city. Any similarities between the Mid-South and the Pittsburgh area, the Midwest even, if you will?
Again, these households in Memphis, Cincinnati, Cleveland, they didn't make as much money as places in California or even D.C. where you saw median incomes close to $90,000, $100,000. It's all in the 50s, but the housing costs are lower. So that kind of is really giving people a break and allowing them the opportunity to save if they're able to take advantage of it.
Would you say it's not surprising that the four most difficult metros to create that emergency fund are all in California and because of that cost of living?
I think we've all heard a lot about California and their rising real estate prices. I was talking to someone from there yesterday talking also about the tax issues. So I think we're not really surprised when we hear that it's unaffordable for people living in California. What we're really watching about that area is to see if real estate prices there and nationwide kind of even out, if they decrease a little bit, which would give people a break and help them save.
Final question. I guess the real question is, do you study how many people truly do have rainy day funds?
Yeah, we study that at bankrate.com. We do an annual survey. We found that last year, I think we did a survey in January, most people wouldn't have $1,000 covered in their savings for an emergency expense. But also the Federal Reserve studies this as well, and they found that nearly 4 in 10 U.S. adults wouldn't even have enough money to cover a relatively small $400 emergency expense. So not a lot of people have these funds set up and are ready should a financial disaster head their way.
Adrian Garcia is a data analyst with Bankrate.com, a personal finance website that has determined the Pittsburgh metro area is the fourth easiest to accrue an emergency savings fund to cover basic expenses for 6 months. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2017, the Pittsburgh Police Bureau closed 58% of reported rape cases. That's a great rate on paper, nearly twice the national average. But WESA's Lucy Perkins reports those numbers may deserve closer scrutiny. Lucy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Lucy, first off, some terminology, if you would. What does it mean to close a rape case?
Yeah, so when someone reports an alleged rape to the police department, the officer who gets the case will do an investigation. And once that investigation's over, they can close the case in a couple different ways. And they use different labels when they're closing those. So one would be like arrest and prosecution, of course. One is cleared by exceptional means, which is when, you know, the officer knows who the suspect is and where they are, but it's beyond the officer's control to make an arrest because that person might be dead or they might be, in prison in another jurisdiction or something like that. And then this third definition is unfounded, which the FBI defines as false or baseless claims.
Okay. How do they determine false or baseless?
Well, they do an investigation and they determine that the claim, for whatever reason, was unfounded, didn't have any that it was false or baseless. I mean, that's
so
the definition.
It was just not true. They determined that.
Sure, but you know, the police department can also label a case unfounded if, you know, someone from Westmoreland County reports a case, an alleged rape to the Pittsburgh police. That would be in a different jurisdiction.
Okay. I want to emphasize to our listeners, we're throwing around a lot of jargon. It is a numbers-heavy story. Lucy, the data you received from the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police said 31% of Pittsburgh's 149 rape cases in 2017, were deemed unfounded, and you just described what unfounded meant. But restating it, that's 46 instances of someone claiming they or someone they were raped by another person that police say were found to be false or baseless. So how serious is that? I mean, how normal are those numbers?
Well, a couple things. I mean, so 31% is almost a third. So that means that almost one out of every three cases of alleged rape that are reported to police, they are deeming for one reason or another unfounded. Again, that could be the jurisdictional issue, which I mentioned before. It could be that a victim later recants and says that the rape didn't occur, which police have told me, you know, is pretty rare that someone would do that. But, you know, ProPublica did a data-heavy report based on 2016 numbers, and the average, you know, unfounding rate in those cases, if you kind of scroll through the number of departments in pretty large cities, is anywhere between, you know, 1% and 20%. So Pittsburgh's is pretty high, and that's what experts I've talked to have said as well.
Have police responded to you and your inquiries, and how so?
Yeah, I mean, the police department said, you know, they take every allegation of rape very seriously. They investigate every case. They said a lot of allegations are reported via Childline, which is a third party phone hotline. And, you know, rightfully so, the police department said a lot of these third party reporters are erring on the side of caution and reporting anything that they find suspicious, which just might not pan out to sexual assault.
And you've reached out to advocates. What have they said about this?
Well, they say these numbers are red flags. They say that, you know, this needs to be looked at more closely, that these numbers are very high, that it doesn't instill a lot of confidence for victims who may choose to report an instance of rape to the police, that one out of every three cases is classified in this way. And obviously, when you classify a rape case as unfounded, it kind of has a different weight than if you classify, you know, something like a burglary as unfounded, just because of the personal nature of the crime.
Critics have claimed that labeling cases as unfounded can enhance a police department's reputation. How so?
Yeah, so I mean, this is where the math gets really tricky, and it's kind of confusing to talk about on the radio when you're not looking at a piece of paper. But so the department had 149 cases in 2017.
Right.
of the cases that were you take the number of unfounded cases out of that total equation.
All
so
right.
You basically reduce the denominator, which means that the number of cases that you actually solve becomes a greater percentage of that total, because these unfounded cases are taken off the caseload for the year.
And briefly, how does the rate of unfounded cases stack up against other cities?
Yeah, it's higher than other cities based on this ProPublica report and the data that they got from various departments across the country. There have been instances in years past in cities like Baltimore, for example, that had a very high unfounding rate. According to a BuzzFeed investigation in 2016, they listed those numbers at about 34%, and Pittsburgh's was in the 30s then as well. So that was pretty high.
Okay, in our last minute, what's been proposed to help bring those numbers down?
So one of the people I talked to for this story is Sue Fritchie of the Women's Law Project here in Pittsburgh. And, you know, she pointed to solutions that have been used in cities like Philadelphia, where they created a third-party independent review panel that annually kind of reviewed the rape allegations and cases and how they were closed by the Philadelphia Police Department, and just kind of just to make sure that everything was on track. So she suggested more transparency in that way.
And any idea if Pittsburgh police would be game for that?
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll look for your full report at WESA.FM. Lucy Perkins is a government and accountability reporter for WESA. Lucy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Andy Warhol Museum is marking its 25th anniversary this week, a start of the celebration of the famed artist's contributions and the museum itself that'll continue over the next several months. We'll speak with Warhol Museum Director Patrick Moore. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit WESA.FM/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Avery Keatley. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a great day of good news.